Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. The time is 1:32 p.m., 23rd of March, 2015. With me today is Senator Giesel, Senator Ellis, Senator Kelly, and myself, Stedman. We have a quorum to conduct business. We're going to have two bills up today. First bill will be initial introduction of Senate Bill 74 dealing with Medicaid reform, sponsored by Senator Kelly. That's why those of you at home don't see him here at the committee table. He's ready to start at the witness stand here. And then at the last 15 minutes, we're going to bring back Senate Bill 23, opioids, by Senator Ellis. We are waiting for the Department of Law to finish up in some other committee meetings. One of the committee members had some questions from the department. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and welcome Senator Kelly.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman.
And if you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and then walk us through the bill. And I think with the complexity of the bill, I would like to, when you walk through it, I would like to take it one section at a time so we can have initial questions by the committee members on each section. And then when we get through all the sections, then we can come back for a more roundabout discussion, because it's a fairly broad bill. And if we don't finish today in the time allotted, then we will continue this following Monday. So I'm more concerned about the quality of the information delivery than the speed at which it's delivered.
Well done, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you know, because you've been around here for a while, and it doesn't take long to figure out that the expansion, not forward, that the increases in Medicaid are eventually going to eat our budget alive. I have a graph on the screen behind you, and it just shows the anticipated growth of Medicaid, and as you can see, it's just going up and up and up.
If we could just stop there for a minute, we'll need the screen. If we could have a brief ideas. On the record, go ahead and continue, Senator Kelly.
The first slide behind you, Mr. Chairman, as you were saying, this is just kind of setting up the need for Medicaid reform. You see that on a line on the graph, it just continues to grow as it has for quite some time. Go to the next one. That slide that you see there shows you how much Medicaid and education take up of our budget. Currently it's almost at half, and Medicaid is the fastest growing of the cost drivers that we have. So bottom line, we just have a problem. We've got to get a hold of what's costing us too much, and over the years attempts to reform it have fallen somewhat flat, and now there's discussion of expansion. I think that's probably a discussion for a different bill, but it's got a lot of people in this building thinking about, well, should we expand, or should we reform, or should we do both? This bill is just about the reforming of Medicaid. I'm just going to run through the top high points of what it does. It instills a medical health care plan, which essentially pays like insurance. Recipients receive a policy that the state pays for it. It's got a case manager that walks the claim through the optimal use of the health care system and keeps them on top of bill paying and making appointments and those kinds of things. They're given a primary care physician. And it's a comprehensive and integrated health care plan. For this piece, for the medical for the health care plan, we'll carve out Denali Kid Care. You can't just impose it on the entire population. Ms. Shattuck can explain that a little later on. I'm sure there'll be questions as to why you can't. We needed to carve out a population. Denali Kid Care was easily identifiable and a high priority. And so that's why we use that. There's going to be some problems that we have tried to deal with that this alone will deal with. It will at least mitigate. And I would say that would be the inappropriate use of ER visits. For one thing, if you have a primary care physician, you don't have a primary care physician. You have someone that is involved in your health care. You have a place to go. Second of all, travel. Again, if you have a primary care physician, there isn't as much need to travel. Now, there's going to be some travel involved, obviously. People are still going to have to go to specialists. People are going to have complications that send them to more high state-of-the-art facilities. But in general, the abuse of the ER room and the travel will be mitigated by this plan. Self-referring to high price specialists, again, back to the primary care physician, and the use of brand name drugs versus generic drugs, which is fairly expensive, but we can manage that a lot better in the health care plan. In addition to the health care plan steerage, we'll apply for choice waivers, and choice waivers are kind of a misnomer. They're actually not a choice waiver. They direct you to tribal facilities if you are eligible for tribal health care. It directs you to a tribal facility. They pay 100%, so the state isn't stuck for that 50% match. There's some emergency room visit reform in this bill. There's telemedicine and a payment reform that refers to bundling rates so that you have a charge for a negotiated charge per procedure, and it allows the state to manage how much it's paying out much better. So essentially those are the pieces. We can get into a lot more detail as we go along, but it addresses some of the things that have cropped up over the years as the biggest abuses and the biggest failures of the current system that we have.
And let the record reflect that Senator Stoltz has arrived.
So, Mr. Chairman, I, for the record, Heather Shattuck, staff to Senator Pete Kelly. I believe you requested going through section by section, which I am prepared to do if you're ready for that.
Can I say one more thing, Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead, Senator.
If you look at the sponsor statement, I wanted to do this. I wanted to make sure that you could get a pretty good sense of what the bill was doing by looking at the sponsor statement. And as you read through the sponsor statement, I ask that each place that if we made a claim, that it refers you to a section in the bill, so that you can find it in the bill as well. So I'm going to go take my seat.
And we'll leave an entire lifeline to your staff to help us with the bill.
Okay.
So you could go through the sponsor statement and then go through the bill, or however you want to lay it out for us. It's up to you.
Sure thing, Mr. Chairman. I'll just highlight one section of the sponsor statement, and I think we'll get into the details as we go through section by section. So Senate Bill 74 starts the process of cost containment and reform needed to slow the growth of the Alaska Medicaid program. Medicaid has grown to $1.8 billion of the annual operating budget and has accounted for 22% of the total UGF increases over the last 10 years. And that was according to some of the graphs we have from Ledge Finance. The current and former administrations have both testified that our current Medicaid program is not sustainable as it stands. Low oil prices and billions of dollars in revenue shortfalls have forced us to change how we do business. In July 2013, the Medicaid Budget Group of the Department of Health and Social Services reported that total spending on Medicaid services would reach $6.3 billion in 2032, including $2.8 billion in state matching funds. So if we don't act now to bend the growth curve of Medicaid, many of our most vulnerable Alaskans will be without the critical health care services they need. And this bill is about reform. And reform is about pushing the right care in the right place at the right time. And some might add for the right price. So we'll just go through section by section and see how we can address that. So section one of the bill adds health savings accounts, and this allows Medicaid recipients to optionally have 10% of their PFDs put into a health savings account or an HSA. We modeled this section after the current PFD college savings plan, and this HSA could cover things like copays, the difference between brand name drugs and generic medicine, replacement eyeglasses if they broke theirs and they're not due for another set. There's just a myriad of options it can be used for. Section 2.
If we could just stop on this section, could you give us a little bit more background on it? I mean, why was 10% selected? Who's going to administer this cost, even though Mike, I know it comes in later in the bill? What kind of process is that going to involve?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So 10% was just picked as a first start. It's definitely an area that, as long as we leave it optional, we may want to take the 10% cap off and allow individuals to put as much of their PFD as they would like into a health savings account. We don't have all of the details yet. This is definitely an area we want to work on, and in Section 3 of the bill we talk about setting up the HSAs in the department as well. We know other states have used health savings accounts. We've talked about them for years, and we just haven't gotten there. We need to put in reforms that are going to start to really bring everybody to the table, get Medicaid recipients thinking about how much their health care costs, ways they can help pay for it, and just the difference. I don't think with our budget situations we can afford not to talk about these concepts. So I will admit we don't have all the ideas fleshed out, and that's what we're hoping we can improve in this committee process.
Senator Diesel.
So, Heather, with health savings accounts, this is pre-tax money, typically. Now, Alaska doesn't have an income tax, but I'm suspecting some of these beneficiaries would still be paying some federal income tax. Mm-hmm. So this would be deductible from their federal taxes. You know, right now we're taxed on our permanent fund, right?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I believe that is correct. I'm sure there are other lifelines out there that could better answer the specifics of that. I know I personally had an HSA at a previous job, and I did have, it was pre-tax deductible, so it was definitely a tax savings for me and quite useful in paying all of the fees I had to pay for my health care.
Senator Kelly, you had okay. So we can explore that in a little more detail. Is there, can they add other funds to it?
Absolutely. We didn't limit that. That was just, as Alaska, we have a unique opportunity with our PFD, so we can utilize that in other areas that other states that have had problems with figuring out how to populate their HSAs, they don't have an option like a PFD. So it was just something we threw out there to consider.
Okay. Any other initial questions on Section 1? Okay, Section 2.
Section 2 is rather lengthy. I mean, it's about a page, but explaining it all is rather lengthy. This is our medical assistance or Medicaid reform program. And this section directs the department to design and implement a program for reforming Medicaid. And there are 11 items that this version of Senate Bill 74 includes. So I will just go through section by section, and feel free to interrupt if there are questions along the way. So subsection 1 on line 7 of page 2, this asks for procedures to use a personal HSA for payments of premiums, co-payments, and deductibles if required of the recipient. Subsection 2 on line 10, we are asking for referrals to community and social support services, including job training, be included. Currently, the state has a lot of training opportunities. There are extensive network of job centers, vocational rehabilitation offices. We have Workforce Investment Act programs, vocational training programs, a lot of supports through our current network of nonprofits that provide services and case management. We want to be working with these agencies. And we know that jobs are the path to self-sustaining individuals and an improved self-image. So our Medicaid program and our case managers should absolutely be interfacing with those type of programs.
And for the rural people that don't have these programs in their community, how would that interact with this?
Mr. Chairman will answer that question.
Go ahead. Senator Kelly?
We can answer that question at a later date.
Just off the cuff, there's a lot of things that can be done online, and many of our programs can offer training online
okay,
as well.
We'll come back to it. Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the issue of the permanent fund dividend, is it the assumption of the sponsor, and I guess in our conversations with the administration, that all these recipients remain eligible for the dividend, that the hold harmless provision is in place for every one of these new 40,000 Medicaid recipients?
I think we're getting two issues on the table at once. That's a little different. Senator Kelly.
There's no expansion in this bill, so it doesn't anticipate the 40,000.
What we're doing here with this bill is trying to do some cost containment Medicaid itself. The expansion will come at a later date in another bill next week.
I'm leaping too far ahead. My apologies.
But at the end of the day, they might, you know, we'll want to take a look at how the whole thing looks together and decide what we want to do, if anything.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, continuing, subsection 3 on line 12 requires a distribution of an explanation of benefits to recipients. We've heard that other states are providing, otherwise known as EOBs, to Medicaid individuals. This may or may not be something states should be doing, according to the feds, so we just want to throw that out there. And again, it's another way to get Medicaid recipients aware of how much their health care costs and just more engaged in the process. Subsection 4 is expanding the use of telemedicine for primary care and urgent care. Subsection 5 is enhancing fraud prevention, detection, and enforcement. A lot has been done under Andrew Peterson at the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, and we just want to encourage as much fraud prevention and enforcement as possible. They've done a lot of work there, saved the state a lot of money, and we know that even more can be done.
Under 4 and 5, I guess when the department who's going to follow you come up and talk about the bill, I would expect them to pursue those two issues regardless. So we'll have a conversation with them. Senator Kelly.
Ms. Cheney, that's a good point. There are some things in this bill that have been in the works. The trigger just hasn't been pulled on them yet.
Continuing, Mr. Chairman, subsection 6 on line 16 states reducing the cost of behavioral health, senior and disability services provided to recipients of medical assistance under the state's home and community-based service waiver. So that's just a lengthy way of talking about home and community-based services. We anticipated a 1915K waiver, like the department has mentioned, and that enhances our FMAP from 50% to 56%. Some other innovative things can be used here, like you can use telemedicine to check in on folks at home. This is where we're anticipating more expanded use. Just check in with somebody who has home-based care and just say, hey, have you taken your meds today? How are you doing? And those kind of things. All of those things keep people at home longer and reduce costs. Subsection 7 discusses pharmacy initiatives. And this is just expanding on what the department has done. They've done a great job encouraging the use of generic meds, claims pricing and payment reforms, prior authorizations, and et cetera. We just want to encourage them to continue that work. Subsection 8 is enhanced care management. This could be set up in a couple different ways. So, and all of these are to teach the proper use of our healthcare system. Healthcare systems can be very overwhelming, and they are not intuitive to access on your own. So this can look like primary care case management with the use of a patient-centered medical home. And this is where a Medicaid user, often a super utilizer, is assigned a primary care provider to oversee their care. They still have access to preventative care, primary care, vaccines, flu shots, and all other appropriate care. And I believe the department has done some of this already. Another example is really special treatment for identified needs. So you're going to want to treat pregnant women a little differently than other parts of the population. They're going to require different care. The same thing with individuals with diabetes and asthma. So you can really cut down on costs if you're doing more engaged things up front. Subsection 9 on line 21 is redesigning the payment process. So that could look like bundled rates for physicians, diagnosis-related groups for hospitals. So, for example, instead of going into a hospital for a knee replacement and getting charged, you know, $10 here for Advil or charged for an IV or charged for this and that, anesthesia, et cetera, there would be one rate for all things related to a knee replacement. This is being done in, I believe, 47 other states for Medicaid, and I think that's going to be 49 currently, and it's done in all states for Medicare, I believe. Subsection 10 is about stakeholder involvement in setting annual targets for quality and cost effectiveness. We know that we can't do this alone, and the department should be working with our stakeholders like ASHNA and our various boards and commissions. They're there for a reason, so we should use them. Subsection 11 talks about reducing travel costs by requiring a recipient to obtain medical services in the recipient's home community to the extent appropriate and when services are available there. So we need to reduce travel where we can. Again, it's expanding telemedicine. And ANTHC, or Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, has really cornered the market in telemedicine. We have a lot we can learn from them. We can work with them on how they've set up their network and expand that beyond the tribal system. We also anticipate a choice waiver, or as Senator Kelly, a not-so-choice waiver, being implemented there, which is mentioned in Section 7. And this would allow just a better coordination of travel overall. If you have somebody who's in a rural community, maybe a mom who also has a child and they're both on Medicaid, you know, mom may need to fly in for some specialty care in Anchorage that's preventative and can be planned out. But why make one trip if her son has to make the same two trips if her son has to make a trip a month later for a dentist visit? So we can really work with travel coordinators and maybe make one trip where a mom would have to follow her son in anyway. And I believe the department has looked at options like that as well.
Right. Before we jump to Section B,
sure.
I think we have to get a federal waiver on this.
We do, which is called for in Section 7.
Okay. And then, this this Section A, asks the department to design and implement. Has there been any, I know this is very early in this process here, but has there been any work done to see that when we design and implement, we actually save money and we don't actually design and implement expansion? And I'm not talking about the expansion in another bill. I'm talking about the departmental expansion and the expansion of the funding needs from the state.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say that mostly we're looking to what are currently available in other states. With the programs that are currently available in other states, that's what we're looking toward, which have produced savings.
So that'll be brought to the committee in more detail, some of the stuff, because one of my concerns is naturally that we don't ask for design and implementation, and then they give us what we ask for, and then they turn around and ask for a bigger GF draw, and our growth rate goes up. What we want is a lower GF draw, and our growth rate slowing down, or preferably reversing if at all possible.
Mr. Chairman, we did receive our fiscal notes pretty late in the day yesterday, so we've just started to review those. From my quick back of the napkin adding and subtracting, it looks like there is a net savings. However, the department did ask for additional positions, so we really want to sit down and just go through some of those because we have the same concerns that you have.
For the members of the committee, I've asked my staff to put together a list of all the fiscal notes. I think there's 14 of them. So we can get an idea of the total GF and federal funds, total staff positions, and operating costs. So we'll just kind of have a summary page. Otherwise, it'll take you a few hours just to go through the fiscal notes. And they may change over time as we work through this bill. But we want to make sure when we add it all up, we're going in the direction you want to go.
Mm-hmm. And from my experience last night, it did take me a couple of hours to go through those fiscal notes.
Section B, please.
So Section B is a report section, and this subsection requires the department to annually report to the legislature realized cost savings related to the reforms set out in Section 2, savings from reform efforts undertaken by the department, and a statement of whether the Department of Health and Social Services has met annual targets for quality and cost effectiveness.
And if I could, how are those set?
The targets for quality and cost effectiveness, Chairman? Those, I believe, we referred back to in the stakeholder involvement helping to set those. We didn't specify more than that. We'd be happy to add a specific.
Oh, that's fine.
Area to okay. Are we ready to go on to section three?
Section three.
Okay. So section three on page three starts on line five. And this, again, is personal health savings account. And this section requires the department to develop and implement a personal health savings account program for Medicaid recipients. And there it would require consumer education strategies, recipient cost sharing and co-payment structures, a procedure for deposits in and payments from health savings accounts, and a procedure for educating recipients about the application process established by the Department of Revenue. That would be where, since that's how they would have to apply, is through the Department of Revenue through their PFDs.
And can you help us a little bit with the structure? Are you talking about a structure held within the state, one of the state departments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this part of the program would actually be in the Department of Health and Social Services, so it's how it would interface with the Medicaid recipients and how they would use HSAs.
Right. So I put in some money, $1,000 or $10,000 or whatever it is, and that money then would have the fiduciary responsibility to administer those funds and track them.
I believe that would be revenue.
Department of Revenue?
I think so. We'll find that out.
Okay, and then if there's a loss of the investment selection, and if there's a loss in those accounts, how is that? I think we need to look at how that's dealt with, and what kind of investment options would be available. And then the fundamental question is: is that the role of the state, and do we want to take that exposure?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I think how we first anticipated these is setting them up like other health savings accounts. So the recipient could have money from their PFD put in there, but an HSA belongs to the individual. It stays with the individual. So if they leave the Medicaid program, that money was their PFD money or money they put in there, and that would follow them. But we can certainly work on hammering out some of those details.
It would be nice when we work through this concept to make sure we're not adding more layers on the state. I don't know what kind of employee count they're looking at in that particular fiscal note, and so on and so forth.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. I believe the department, when I did an initial run-through with them, they said that could require a lot more upfront work for them, so I think it's a valid concern. If so pleases, I'll continue. Section 4, which is just one line, page 3, line 18, this sunsets the personal health savings accounts in sections 1 and 3 and the Medicaid reform program in section 2 on October 1st, 2022. And this is simply a tool to bring these back in front of the legislature. We want to know if these reforms are working and what should be changed. Healthcare delivery is constantly evolving, so our Medicaid program should constantly be reforming at the same rate. We also know the legislature deals with big things every year, so maybe in a couple of years, Medicaid will be off the radar of some folks, and this is just a mechanism to bring it back in front.
And the magic of 2022, is it, why was that date chosen versus not shorter or longer?
It was a starting point for us. We just picked 7 years, kind of long enough to know if it works. If the committee wants it shorter, I don't think we're opposed to that. It was just a date we started with.
Yeah, I don't know if it should be shorter or longer. Just
No magic.
There's no
magic, yeah.
That's fine.
Okay, Section 5 is our Medicaid Managed Care Demonstration Program for individuals enrolled in Denali KidCare and an opt-in for other Medicaid recipients. So in subsection A, which starts on line 23 of page 3, we picked Denali KidCare because, as Senator Kelly said in his opening remarks, it's an easily identified high-priority population to test managed care on. Alaska is currently one of only 12 states that does not use managed health plans in some form of their Medicaid program. Individuals would be managed by traditional insurance carriers like Moda, Aetna, or Primera. There's also an added social benefit. These individuals, we would anticipate getting insurance card instead of a Medicaid card. So as they're walking into a doctor and they're asked, you know, hey, what insurance do you have? Instead of saying Medicaid, they could say, oh, I have Aetna. So it's just a little bonus perk. Some folks have run health plans like these, and they cite better outcomes, more one-on-one engaged care. And this managed care program would include comprehensive care management and care coordination. So, for instance, once a woman becomes pregnant, she would be engaged by a primary care case manager, and this would be her go-to person. There would be check-ins along the way to make sure the woman is having a healthy pregnancy, taking prenatal vitamins, getting her questions answered by the same provider. The goal is the healthiest outcomes we can have. This type of health plan sets up relationships and trust between providers and patients. If the provider is engaged on this type of level and continually checking in with the patient, they might pick up that there are problems that the woman is uncomfortable disclosing at first. So it just encourages that trust, which we know works better. This program also requires, in subsection A, individual and family support and referrals to community and social support services, including job training. Again, this is about the whole person, not just immediate health care, and that's really changing how the state does case management. Okay.
Are you done with that section?
I was going to just highlight a little bit in subsection D, if that works. In subsection D, under the managed care demonstration project, it must, which is on page 4, it must include cost-saving measures that include innovations like reducing travel through the expanded use of telemedicine for primary and urgent care. And again, ANTHC is leading the way. They have shown that 40% of it's about an average, 40% of telemedicine visits have avoided travel. And again, in that subsection, we're asking to simplify administrative procedures for providers, including streamlining the audit, payment, and stakeholder engagement procedures. And this project, again, like the other sections, would sunset on October 1st, 2022.
The initiation date here of October 1st, 15. Can this program be stood up that fast?
I will, through the chair, I will let the department answer to that. However, our goal was to put some hard deadlines in this bill in order to see some savings on a real timeline. We just feel like we can't afford to wait. So that was our aggressive nature of the dates.
And then the managed care, the section, was it modeled after particular states, or where did you work out the concept?
Mr. Chairman. The managed care is it's modeled after other states. I mean, there's companies that you simply contract with, and they take over Aetna, Moda, others. So it's a pretty well prepackaged thing that can be put in place, from what I've learned, fairly quickly.
So do we have comparative analysis done on people or states that have done this?
I don't have one with the packet, no. We'll get that for you.
Yeah, or we can ask the department for help or what have you as we work through this. It'd be nice to have, if there is states that have implemented this, to actually look at their results, yeah, both positive and negative.
We'll give you your office, Mr. Chairman, and get that for you.
Any other questions on the section from community members? Section 6
starts on page 5, line 7, and this section requires the department to design and implement a demonstration project to reduce non-urgent use of the emergency department by Medicaid recipients. So this section of the bill would build on what the department has already done with their super utilizer program. Again, it's about directing individuals to the right care at the right time in the right place. In this section, subsection A5, which is on line 24, sets up a process for referring a frequent ER user or super utilizer to a primary care provider within 96 hours after an ER visit. This section also includes strict guidelines for the prescription of narcotics and a prescription monitoring program. The department has seen great efforts with their super utilizer program, and we know it can be expanded.
So what is this on line 15? What's this mean, the extent of federal law, the system of electronic exchange? What's the issue with the federal law and the electronic exchange of patient information?
Taking an initial stab, because Ledge Legal put that in there, but I believe that's referring to HIPAA laws. So there's only so much we can do. We have to follow HIPAA, which that acronym I cannot roll off the tip of my tongue. But
Mr. Chairman, I think it stands for Health Information Patient Protection Act.
That was a pretty good stab at it. It's not.
So on line 17, the process for defining and identifying, what's the bill sponsor's concept on that, or are we just leaving this to the administration to work out, or the department, or what?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the department already has a process for identifying these frequent users since they already have a current program. If that program is working, I don't see any need to change it except for maybe expanding the infrastructure needed to handle it.
Okay. Senator Diesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the hospitals in Anchorage is actually implementing or proposing to implement a regional emergency room that they have put in place in at least two other states. They do this type of program where a frequent user of the emergency room who doesn't have a primary care provider is connected with a local provider, hopefully someone that's nearby that regional emergency room. Obviously, they can get there easier. They have found significant reduction in ER use and cost of care.
Yes, when we get the department up here and go through it, we'll find out what's actually what they're already doing and what we're asking them to do. So we'll sort some of this stuff out.
And just in addition to that, I believe the department can expand on this, but since the Anchorage Neighborhood Clinic moved to its new location, I believe that section of Anchorage has some of the highest super utilizers because that clinic is no longer there. So I think there's some great stories that go along with that and the need to expand this type of program.
And is there any data on the frequent users, if it's like a lot of other areas? Are other issues sometimes, like 20% of the people use 80% of the assets type of issues we run into? Is we have any idea how few people it takes to absorb what percent of the resources here at all?
Mr. Chairman, in our discussions, I've heard that number, but I frankly don't remember what it was. Do you?
I don't off the top of my head. I do know that some organizations have done some great work for their area. Specifically, the Matsu Health Foundation has those numbers drilled down for the Matsu. I believe some of their numbers show that a lot of those users are behavioral health users in some sort of behavioral health crisis. So we can work with the various groups like the department and the health foundations and try to get a statewide number for you. Continuing on with Section 7, which is on page 6, line 6. This requires the department to apply for a provider choice waiver if the waiver is necessary to implement portions of the Medicaid reform program in Section 2. And again, this is just another tool for steerage. So this could be steering an Indian Health Services beneficiary with Medicaid to an IHS facility in their hometown, which increases the FMAP to 100% versus 50%. It could also be steering folks on the road system to a closer clinic to avoid travel.
Senator.
Heather, does this also require the choice waiver?
This is the choice waiver.
Okay,
this is just requiring it if it's okay. It is required in Section 2.
Okay.
Section 8, Mr. Chairman, is on line 11, and these are feasibility studies. As you know, feasibility studies are required before any state service can be privatized. And we specifically asked for studying the privatization of Alaska Pioneer Homes, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, and select facilities of the Division of Juvenile Justice. We don't anticipate potential privatization would look the same for each facility. For example, there are currently private psychiatric hospitals that are doing this work across the country, we are finding that they are doing this work cheaper, with better outcomes, and with better care for our actual employees. You will find that API has some of our highest rates of workers' comp claims.
Two things. Selected facilities of the Division of Juvenile Justice. What is select facilities?
Mr. Chairman, there's two that could be turned over, like to the Regional Health Corporation, the Nome facility and the Ketchikan facility.
Okay, so why won't they just specify it in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, we certainly can specify. We didn't want to limit it at first blush. And just to expand on the Nome option, that could be turned into a residential psychiatric treatment center. Currently, these DJJ facilities are not eligible for Medicaid billing. If you turn it into an RPTC, and turn it over to a tribal facility, not only are these youth getting appropriate care, but they're getting culturally relevant care. And we're using the tribes, which have the capacity to do so.
For those watching at home, just don't panic. This is the first hearing on this bill. These are concepts. Mm-hmm. So don't run out of the room with your hair on fire thinking everything's for sale. These are just concepts put on the table to talk about, and we'll work through that process. Senator Kelly.
More on that Ketchikan facility. It probably qualifies less. That's one of the reasons we didn't want to necessarily bring it into the bill as in statute. Probably the Nome facility is at a higher level of discussion because it just meets more criteria, less so the Ketchikan, but we didn't want to put either of them in there or remove them, just select facilities.
And was there any discussion or thought of the state prisons?
Mr. Chairman, that just wasn't a part of this bill. However, I know the administration has discussed privatization. Governor Walker mentioned it in his State of the State, and I believe our OMB director is exploring other options. But we know feasibility studies are the first step, so that was why we asked for these to be done as soon as possible.
And then they're asking for the report coming 10 days after the convening, of the second regular session. One of the things I found here, we get so many reports after we start up, you don't have time to go through them as much if you get them earlier. So is there, what's the magic of 10 days after versus trying to get stuff generally to the legislators prior to convening so we actually have time to read through some of the documents in a little more detail?
Mr. Chairman, our drafter kind of arbitrarily picked that. We asked for them, and I do not think we are opposed to putting that date earlier. I believe the fiscal notes reflect that the department will contract out for this service anyway.
Okay. Next section, please.
Section 9 on line 21, still on page 6, requires the department to amend the state Medicaid plan and apply for any waivers necessary to implement the projects and programs described in the bill. Section 10 sunsets Section 11 on October 1, 2022. And Section 11 just provides that Section 1 through 3 of the bill take effect only if the department certifies to the revisor of statutes on or before October 1, 2017, that all of the provisions enacted by Sections 2, 3, 5 through 7 and 9 of the bill have been approved by the United States Department of Health and Human Services. And Mr. Chairman, that concludes our walking through.
Do we have any other initial questions for her before we jump back to Ledge Finance slides? And if we could drop back for a minute to the Ledge Finance slides, if you could back up your presentation a couple of slides, please.
Sure. Which slide do you want to focus on first?
Well, it doesn't really matter. Just go backwards one because the point will be here. I don't have that one.
I know. Okay. This is the very first one that you have in the packet.
Okay. And let's, it's just a couple points. We've had, and for those watching at home, you'll see that the red bars are general funds, but we had a lot of restating of within our coding system, I think in 2010, other funds back to general funds that were actually general funds, but they were coded as other state funds. And for a decade plus in this building, we were intentionally understating general fund expenditures and reclassifying fund sources. That was unwound through the legislature, the two finance committees, and OMB. It took about a year and a half, a couple of years, something like that, to unwind that mess. So when you look back in time to compare general fund expenditures to current expenditures and try to extrapolate the growth curves, you basically end up with some data errors that make your analysis basically meaningless. So I'm going to ask Reg Finance to reconstitute these charts, either go back and readjust the 06 numbers back or add most state funds so we can actually see what's going on through the entire growth area of these funds, and also add inflation to these so we can get an inflation feel for it and population change in percentage. Because we're trying to figure out our costs and real dollars as a, and relative to our population centers. There's another chart. There's a line chart. If you can back up one more. That one right there. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we'll have a discussion with Ledge Finances and try to find out what went on in, unless you know, 2010 and 2012, where you see this increase of over $200,000 in general fund expenditures, why that jump was there, and what's implementing that. Do you happen to know that?
I know a little bit, Mr. Chairman. Part of the years before that, there was an enhanced FMAP as part of the recovery program, stimulus program through the federal government. So that we did ask for some explanation, and the department provided us that the different years. I will forward that to the committee. It's in charts and not on a graph, so it's hard. We will try to overlay those, but particularly the enhanced FMAP from the stimulus and when that ended is part of the reason for the jump. It would have been more gradual, but that happened.
So what we'll look for is the breakdown of that. Also, we want to check to make sure the data and the general funds here, 06, 07, so on and so forth, is meaningful data, not distorted. And I'm not sure exactly where that is. And I see a hand going up in the back. Amanda, is that you back there in the dark? If you can come forward,
please. She's the one who created these wonderful terms.
We'll get her up here for her. If she can come forward. For those at home, she works for Lead Finance, or nonpartisan finance arm. If you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and help the committee with this data, please.
For the record, my name is Amanda Ryder, and I work with the Legislative Finance Division. And first of all, I would like to say that actually the GF data is apples-to-apples comparisons. Although those fund codes, we did reclassify them, those fund codes, they do go backwards. So that is not an issue. We have apples to apples historical comparisons. Mm-hmm. I know there has been some confusion over that, and I don't know how OMB does it, but Ledge mm-hmm. Finance is able to.
Well, you just aren't confused, so that's good.
All right. The other is that that dip is primarily the Affordable Care Act, as Heather has stated. And that was the enhanced FMAP when the when the ERA bill, American Recovery and mm-hmm. Reinvestment Act, passed. There was an enhanced FMAP, and as a result, less GF was needed because it went up to almost 60%. It was like 58% match as opposed to the 50% match, slightly different, but approximately that. And so as a result, less GF was needed, and so that little dip really was kind of where federal funds filled in that gap during that time. And that ended in FY12, and so it went to the more the normal FMAP rate of about 50-50. So that occurred, I think, in FY12 was the last of the ERA funding.
Okay, so then maybe you can help us, because this is the first hearing on the bill, with with the growth analysis starting in, looks like, 12 maybe, going forward, where the curve looks more linear?
Yes.
And to try to get a feel for what growth rate that is, because it looks like it did dip down in the management plan of 15, the last section of your little blue line.
15 to 16.
That dip down is actually, Mr. Chairman, is the $20 million decrease that the governor put in the budget in health care Medicaid services. Mm. And that was in the governor's amended budget, and that was based on potential savings, I think, is what that increment or that decrement.
Okay. So the last hard numbers is basically the peak in the blue line. We don't know what we're going to do with that budget yet.
Mm-hmm. That's the FY
management plan,
15 management plan, and the governor's request is right where the other two lines start.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you can come back, or you can come back and give us some growth curves on that stuff. It's pretty hard for us to do with just a data point. We don't have the numerics. In other words, I don't know if it's, I see your percentage here, your growth rate percentages, but it'd be nice to see on the real numbers versus the budgetary number. So 16, the current year, we don't know what we're going to do with our budget. It's not done yet.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. And so are you asking me to come back when?
I want to know the rate of growth from 12 to 15.
Okay.
Actual numbers. Even though we don't have 15 done till the end of June, we can get pretty close. And then we can adjust down for whatever decrement we may have in the budget process between the House and the Senate and the or the legislature and the governor's proposal. Clearly, we're going to ratchet it back. But I guess I'm trying to figure out and help the committee with where we've been, mm-hmm. and then we can figure out where we're at, and then we can figure out where we're going to go. But until that's all clear, I don't want to sit here 2 years from now in the building and find out we put forth a good bill and found out we actually accelerated our growth rates in the exact opposite direction that this bill is trying to push us.
And Mr. Chairman, I would certainly caution you, these growth rates I have are really just historical, and then based on the 12 to 16 rates, I have no idea whether any of this will happen. This is strictly a numerical calculation based on past rates, and the department is probably going to have a much better idea of future projections and what decisions that they're making or that this bill is going to make will have on future numbers. But I can certainly provide you growth rates based on history.
Mm-hmm.
The future rates are certainly, I'm going to have trouble certainly determining the impact.
Along with everybody else.
That's true.
But if you could on this, maybe help us with some definitions of what you did earlier in our documentation here with the chart, so it's clear what these growth areas are with the Affordable Care Act. Because if you look at this chart, you always see lines. You don't see the drivers that pushed it down in the 9 and 10 or what happened to drive it up in 11 and 12. Senator Kelly.
Amanda, if you could clarify for me. So something happened somewhere around 2012, and the Medicaid growth line flattened out, correct?
That is certainly, that's what's been budgeted, yes.
Right.
That has.
And so the yellow line shows that curve continuing, and the red line shows the historic. Is that what you're telling us?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Senator Kelly, that is correct. I was very uncomfortable giving an 06 to 16 growth rate, considering I think that would have really distorted the growth, simply because there was an enhanced FMAP in FY06 that's greater than what we have now. And so there have been a number of changes that I think using that 06 to 16 would have distorted the growth, made it appear higher. Mm-hmm. However, using the 12 to 16 also, I think, is probably too low. So I put both in there, and we can all draw our conclusions as to where that may be.
Mm-hmm. And then if you could help us, too, with the population of the state and inflation. Those kind of two major components, and we should have some kind of correlation, I hope, between our population and inflation. At least it gives us a little bit of a benchmark, because when I look down and I see just on anything, any of the departments, like here, a 5.8 just percent growth in and of itself, it's doubtful that inflation is going to be that high. So we're embedding real growth rates within the department is the way I look at it. So trying to help differentiate that.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to get those numbers to you with the inflation-adjusted, population-adjusted numbers.
Yeah.
We have that.
Just for a better feel. It is a huge, as we all know, we mentioned before, it is a huge component. 22% is the number I think you used in your presentation of our budget. Do you have other questions for Ledge Finance? You escaped, and thank you for being here today. That was a good call to come here.
And Mr. Chairman, that 22%, so I don't, because I'm sure the department would correct us, that was specific to the total UGF increase from FY06 to FY15. So it's specific to the increase in our budget, not the overall budget.
All right. Do we have other questions for the bill sponsor before we bring the administration up for 15 minutes? Seeing none, if we can have the commissioner or the lifelines, however she wants to work it, come forward. Madam Commissioner Designee, I guess, and Mr. Sherwood, however you guys want to do it, but it'd be nice for you to, because we spent some time on the sectional analysis, to walk through the components of the bill, unless you have particular areas that, of the bill that you want to address first. And you got about 15 minutes, maybe 20 at the most.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Valerie Davidson, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Health and Social Services. With me is John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner. And thank you to the committee, and thank you to Senator Kelly for the bill and the opportunity to speak today. There are some areas for Medicaid reform identified in this bill that have also been recognized by the administration, and they're included in the governor's bill as well, continuing the reform efforts that the sponsor indicated that the department has already undertaken, including reducing the costs for Alaskans with behavioral health needs and those in need of senior and disability services through the 1915 I and K options that allows our state to be able to enhance our federal match. Enhancing other federal match opportunities, for example, the 100% federal match where possible, including enhancing the tribal provider's ability to provide care. And also committing the department to actively pursue reform opportunities everywhere they can be found. There are several areas of the bill that will require a little more clarification and time from the department to be sure that we realize savings for the state. Some of them were mentioned earlier. The health savings account program, we've had conversations with the sponsor's staff to talk about what exactly that would entail. We've definitely made sure that they knew that this is not an area that is certainly within our area of expertise, and we would require some additional help at the start to be able to implement that program. And a couple of other demonstration projects, the Medicaid Managed Care Project and the reduction of non-urgent emergency department use. Let me take the second one first. The superutilizer is one, as the sponsor indicated, that the department has already undertaken. We estimate that there are about over 5,000 super-utilizers or over-utilizers of the emergency department, and we have already matched a number of them up with a care manager, a person that they call on the phone, or actually the person calls them. When the program first began at the department, I think people were nervous that they might see that as an intrusion, and what actually happens is that the Medicaid beneficiaries love it because somebody cares about their health. They're matching them up with a primary care provider, making appointments for that person, saying things like, you know, we see that from your last several emergency room visits, it sounds like you might benefit from seeing this particular type of provider. We've set up an appointment with you on Tuesday. Does Tuesday work for you? And then calling that individual back on Monday and saying, I want to remind you of your appointment tomorrow. Do you have a ride? Is this time still work for you? So that has been helpful.
Senator Diesel?
Could I quick ask a question, Commissioner? So what number of these super utilizers out of the 5,000 have you implemented this demonstration model with?
Through the chair, Senator Diesel, we have targeted 2,000 as an initial starting point, but we believe that there's opportunity for more, and certainly that's reflected in this bill as well as the department's ongoing reform effort. So we will welcome the opportunity to expand.
Okay, so follow up. When did you begin doing this?
For the record, this is John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner of Health and Social Services. I believe we started in December or January, so only a couple months have we started. And I think to date our contacts are probably in the 100. This is a voluntary program. We're not actually connecting with everyone on day one of the program. But I don't have the most current statistics because it is pretty new.
And is there a particular community that you're targeting this implementation in, or is it randomly statewide?
Through the chair, Senator Diesel, I believe most, if not all, of the initial targeting was in the Anchorage area, but I would have to confirm that. I know we plan to go out broader, but I think initially they were starting in Anchorage, where we had identified a number of high users.
Thank you.
And if you can get back to the committee with more detail on that, we'd appreciate it. Sure.
We'd be happy to. In terms of a Medicaid managed care project, I guess just speaking about delivering care and making sure that we get the right care to the right person at the right time and for the right price, there's managing the care of a patient, and then there's a separate legal managed care organization, which is a totally separate legal structure, which are implemented in other states. And as the sponsor indicated, we don't have a managed care organization structure here in Alaska. If the intent is to do a legal managed care organizational structure such as it exists in other states, that is something that is a lot more labor intensive in terms of setting that up, negotiating an agreement with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. There are also some requirements under federal law under the Affordable Care Act that ensure that if individuals are enrolled in managed care organizations for certain kinds of eligibility, that they are allowed to either opt out or there are requirements for them to be able to access services. For example, tribal members to some degree in the lower 48 states, a lesson learned from other states, in California especially. There was a time when managed care organizations were paid to manage the care of beneficiaries, including IHS beneficiaries, who are mandatorily enrolled in programs who weren't receiving their care from those providers within their preferred provider organizations. Instead, the care they were receiving was through the tribal health organization in that state, but the managed care organizations were not paying for the care to the tribal organizations. And so there was a change in federal law that requires that when this happens, that those kinds of things don't occur again. Now, if on the, so that's sort of one very, very structured legal legal structure to be able to do a managed care organization in the, you know, the tightest legalist, I don't even know if that's a word, but anyway, in one very, very structured format. If, on the other hand, what we're talking about is managing the care of beneficiaries, then we have a lot more flexibility in terms of being able to negotiate a waiver with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that will allow us to be able to achieve the same result without as much complication. It's still challenging. It'll still take time to be able to negotiate, but it is a little bit less cumbersome.
Thanks, Senator. Stoltz, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick one, not to really answer it this iteration, but Ms. Shattuck went through a fairly exhaustive process of the sections. If the administration could just punch list them, which ones are consensus items, which ones are problematic and the reasons therefore, and which one of them are drop-dead deal breakers. And that would, just that kind of clarity and directness would really be appreciated.
If you're prepared for that, or if you're not, they'll be working on it over the next week to do that, to basically come together on the hard areas and the soft areas.
That was my intent, Mr. Chairman, later. I don't want to cut into her 8 or 9 minutes left.
So we'll get back to the committee on that, because they'll be tasked with that duty over the next week.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then the other thing that's going to require a little more clarification is in terms of referring to community and social support services. That is definitely something that we definitely support in terms of employment services, for example. However, the committee should know that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services so far has not approved a waiver from a state requiring employment counseling or employment services. It is something they have allowed states to do on a voluntary basis, so we can't compel an individual to participate, but we can certainly make those services available. And then the last thing is that the biggest gap in the bill, from our perspective, of course, is that it doesn't include Medicaid expansion. We believe that that expansion and reform really go hand in hand, and believe that not including expansion really is a missed opportunity. But we recognize that, you know, that is definitely a difference in terms of position and a difference in terms of strategy.
And a different bill. We have a bill up for those watching at home. Will be a week from today. Okay. In this very room, we'll have an expansion bill in front of the committee.
Thank you. And then also, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, as you've seen, we've assembled 13 fiscal notes, and there are a lot, because there are a lot of reforms that were outlined in the bill that hit so many of our different budget components. And there are some, like specifically the ones that we mentioned at the beginning, that were really aligned with the reform efforts that we are already undertaking as a department, and also the efforts that are included in another bill. We were able to have more precision on those because we think we have a better sense of what those are. But in others, we've done a little more speculating, and we certainly, through conversations with the sponsors' staff, have agreed to sit down and work through those. And once we have a better sense of what exactly they had in mind and what we think will work, we can refine those as we move through the process. We do anticipate, based upon what we know so far, we've anticipated undesignated general fund savings of $1.1 million in FY 2016, increasing to $17.9 million by 2021, based on our best understanding of the bill. And I do want to echo that what I said before, and also echo the statements of the sponsor that reform is a process. It is not necessarily a point in time. It's not like we can go and flip on the switch today and suddenly the magic begins tomorrow. It truly is a process as we're moving forward. We really are excited about the opportunities to be able to reform Medicaid. We have undertaken many of those efforts already, and we look forward to working with the legislature to be able to, and certainly the sponsor on this committee, to be able to continue those reform efforts. That said, we also want to make sure that that it, we do so on a timeline and on a work schedule that that is doable for our state and, quite frankly, doesn't kill me or the deputy commissioner in the process. It's a heavy lift.
And if those, I assume, are aggregate numbers of the 13 or so fiscal notes in draft. I know you guys have worked very hard to get something to the committee for this initial meeting, and so everybody should just kind of remember that they'll be revised as we go forward a little bit and refined, and then the total number of employees you're looking at adding in those fiscal notes. Do you have that by chance?
Mr. Chair, looking at the cheat sheet my staff provided me, it is 9 employees in the initial year, peaking at 12 in the second and third year, and then falling to 11 in the out years.
So the committee will work on that issue. We have questions for the commissioner. She's got a couple more minutes left before we run off the hot seat. And they are enthusiastically looking forward to the next week to working with the bill sponsor on these details to see what, like Senator Stoltz had mentioned, where there's alignment, where there's not, so we can concentrate our time on things that aren't being replicated. Seeing Senator Kelly, you have a
Now, when you talked about managing care versus implementing a managed care system, you were actually talking about taking the resources that you have currently and managing care. That's one way to do it. And then when we were talking about a management system, that would be more like a hiring Aetna or somebody to come in and do a managed care facility. Was that, did I pick up on that correctly?
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, setting up a managed care organization, mm-hmm. which would be like setting up a separate legal structure that is a managed care organization that would be contracted to be able to provide that service. It can be very, very complicated, or it can be something that's much more simple. Which I think, if I'm interpreting correctly, I think as described in the bill, setting up a managed care demonstration project is something that is a little bit more fluid. One of the big differences is doing the difference between risk. So is it a capitated system that's capitated payment pool? Or is it, for example, providing an administrative fee for the contractor or the insurance company or whomever the contractor is to be able to do this as an additional service to be able to track those costs over time, and then they are allowed perhaps to be able to share in some of those savings opportunities. I guess, I'm sorry, in a nutshell, if I probably made it more complicated than it needed to be. These kinds of demonstration programs and projects, there are a tremendous amount of different possibilities. And I guess to answer your question in a shorter version, we would definitely want to sit down with you and your staff to get a sense of what it is that you are thinking. Is it something that is going to be a lot more legally complex, or are you thinking of something that is going to be a little bit easier for us to manage with our limited resources, given our challenging fiscal environment, but also can end in the same result? And I think you're looking at the latter.
Right, no, certainly don't want to complicate things.
Final comments before we set this meeting,
Mr. Chairman?
Okay, thank you for coming in today, the department, and I will thank you a week early, for the work coming over the next week, because I know it's going to take a little bit, and Senator Kelly's staff, and we'll try to boil this down as we work forward the next couple of weeks on this issue. With that, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside. Next up. We've got Senate Bill 23, Behavioral Health. We had some issues, questions and concerns, sponsored by Senator Ellis, and there were questions and concerns from Senator Stoltz. If we could have someone from the Department of Law come forward.
Oh, yeah.
This, for those watching at home, an act, this bill, Senate Bill 23, is an act relating to immunity for prescribing, providing, and administering opiate overdose drugs. And before we get into the question, maybe we can have Senator Ellis give the public, didn't have the opportunity to see it at the last meeting, a brief overview of the bill and what it does, and then we'll go into Senator Stoltz's questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you having the bill back before the committee today. I know the senator from Chugiak had a concern about civil liability, criminal liability, and the Department of Law will speak to that. And I would note that if the committee, depending on what your thoughts are today, the bill does have a further referral to the Senate Judiciary Committee for legal review and other issues. But the legislation is pretty simple. It provides a relief for civil liability for those who would administer these overdose reversing drug. It's an EpiPen, essentially. Naloxone is the drug. And 29 other states have done this. It's pretty simple. No known opposition, and I appreciate your consideration. And I am looking forward to the response about the bill, as I understand it, or know it to be, deals with civil relief from civil liability in these life-saving situations for doctors and family members or friends to save lives during an overdose, rather than any relief from criminal liability. But that's the basic essence of a simple bill.
Senator Stoltz, you want to restate your concerns, your questions?
Yes. For the phone? Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't really have a lot of problems with it, just other than the issue I asked about, and I wanted to clarify on the record. I don't sit on the Judiciary Committee, so this is my chance to ask the question. And we've had a lot of drug bills. Some of them get pushed real fast, and then we find out some issues that weren't paid attention to. So the issues were on the – it's real clear on the civil liability that for the responders, but as in other bills, with any concerns the Department of Law are creating openings that would the actual person who caused the drug overdose, often it's older people with younger girls, and it's just not opening up a loophole where we're alleviating both the civil liability and then even creating unintentionally a mitigator. Just your comments. I'm sorry about the long question. I want to make sure I got it out.
If you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and help the committee with the question, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Sabatnian, the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. There seems to me like there's two parts to Senator Stoltz's question. One is a mitigating factor, and the other is it eliminating some type of criminal liability that people may have. If I got that correct, if I may, through the chair, Senator Stoltz, this bill doesn't have anything to do with sentencing in criminal cases, and that's generally where we're talking about mitigating factors. So we're not talking about making it less of a sentence because a drug dealer at some point administered one of these during the course of an emergency one of these new drugs that deal with overdoses. In regards to the criminal liability, this bill has no effect on that either. This is simply a civil matter dealing with the people who either prescribe or set standing orders for having such drugs, like police officers. A lot of the programs that are run across the country are the police officers are given these drugs. EMTs who respond who have the drugs in the ambulance. It protects them from civil liability unless there's some gross negligence on their part. It also protects family members from administering the drugs.
Mr. Chairman, just quickly, Mr. Chairman, to Mr. Sabatnian, that the person that may have caused the overdose, that are all self-inflicted, and just I want to make sure that we're not lessening the legal burden for that person just because he makes a phone call to the, or does take some type of what's been, I think, charitably called Good Samaritan acts. It's, so.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, there was a bill that was introduced and passed last year that dealt with people who were notifying emergency responders, and that no evidence could be used from that phone call or the response from by emergency people to that event. So. That's an entirely different bill. It was not dealt with at an earlier time, and it set the parameters. It doesn't relieve, the bill that passed last year doesn't relieve people of total responsibility for distributing the drugs. That's what the Department of Law is concerned, where we were concerned about with some aspects of the bill that passed last year. As far as I know, it's not come up in the last year. This doesn't deal with that at all. This just deals with civil matters, means doctors, nurse practitioners, health aides in villages, either in dispensing them to these drugs to family members or actually administering dispersing them to family members to administer to a person who's having an overdose and to the people actually administering the drug.
Mr. Chairman, just one last question. I think it's a yes-no question. Does the administration support the bill?
Through the chair, yes. If I just may elaborate on that, the Department of Corrections really thinks that it will be helpful to them. They see a lot of overdoses in the jail, and they want to deal with it immediately. They want to have a standing order from a doctor that they can administer these drugs, and they feel like that will protect them from any civil.
Do we have other questions for Pamela? Any other questions of the bill sponsor? Senator Ellis, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, with that review, I appreciate the committee's time and attention, and I'll move that Senate Bill 23 move to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and an accompanying zero fiscal note.
And we have a motion to move the bill to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Any objection? Seeing none, we'll move the bill to the next committee of referral. That ends the workload today. We will reconvene here 1 week from today and continue working over 20% of our budget with the Health and Human Services. We are adjourned.